Welcome, friends, to yet another episode, episode 14 of To The Unknown Pod. My name is Jordan Bush. I'm the executive director of TGFB Media. We exist to help Christians understand and use Bitcoin for the glory of God and the good of people everywhere. Today, I am joined by two of the three Island Boys. Mm-hmm. Our friend Matt is doing important pastoral things, so he's not here. I'll let my other guys introduce themselves. Go for it.
Hey, it's Oshawa Hawthorne, founder and director of Brilliance Labs. We're a boutique innovation and startup lab in Portland, Oregon. We help empower bright ideas with Bitcoin.
I'm Ryan Finley, founder of Tracker, or co-founder of Tracker with my son, father of six, entrepreneur, lover of Bitcoin.
And today, here we are, episode 14. This is, we very subtly entitled this episode, World War Trump. We're going to get into that in a few minutes. But first of all, maybe you just stumbled across us on the interwebs, wherever you are. And you might have thought to yourself, what in the world did I get myself into? Basically, what we do is we spend time on we spend time on Twitter every week. And so as Christians, we want to basically be good stewards of the things that we do. And that includes our time on Twitter. So we want to redeem the tweets, the Twitter time. So what we do is we find tweets all throughout the week and we save them and just basically save them for a time like this when we can just say to ourselves, hey, man, I found this tweet. I think it's really helpful, but I'd love to get Ash's take on this or Ryan's take or Matt's take or something. We just would love to talk about them with each other. And so that's what we're going to do. So again, some of these are going to be funny. Some of these are just serious and more germane to our lives as dads or husbands or Bitcoiners or friends or whatever it happens to be. So you'll see a wide variety of things. I thought you were going to say something, Ash. And so we'll start out this week with an update. And of course, when I try to do it, it's not going to work. But no, I'm just kidding. It's working. All right. With an update on TGFB, our new project, The Orange Umbrella. That's right. Orange Umbrella. It is nominally a Bitcoin book. It's written for kids nominally, but again, plenty of Easter eggs in there for adults that are really going to like it. It's basically like if Pixar and Dr. Seuss and Charlotte Mason, if you know who that is, wrote a kid's book. We don't use the B word, the Bitcoin word, one time, but we wrote this book. We just think it's a really going to be a good one, one that will hopefully go down as a Bitcoin kids book classic. So you can go over to Kickstarter right now. We are doing a Kickstarter campaign. We are 2/3 of the way there, almost 66%. Again, I was going to make some joke on Twitter about our dispensational friends not leaving us at 66.6%. If we were to get there. So please be very, generous and help us make sure we leap over that barrier so we don't cause those brothers to stumble. We are doing well here. We're well on our way. We still have 27 days left, but we would love to knock this thing out. So go grab your copy. This is a great orange pilling tool for your non-Bitcoiner friends and relatives. That'd be great. Now, moving away from the shilling, okay? We're moving on into some of the things from the week here. We're going to share this first of all. Just something to wet your little beak here, okay? So I found this yesterday as I was surfing around, and I've thought this would be something interesting to talk about. So here's Alex Thorne. Alex Thorne works for Galaxy Digital, and he shared this from an interview with Peter.
So the guy who did the investigation for us came to us with a thesis on who he thought it was. But I'm not going to say.
Yeah.
Now, let's clarify who he thought Satoshi Nakamoto was. Little background. Craig Wright sued Peter McCormack. So Craig Wright is a scammer who sued Peter McCormack. Peter hired an investigator. He tried to find out who Satoshi was. And so this is what happened as a result. There we go.
I wouldn't even say off camera. I think we all should hold that policy central to us as a Bitcoiner.
Yeah.
And he found this blog this character had written. And it was fascinating. It kind of felt like you were potentially seeing into the mind of Satoshi.
Pretty early, prior to Bitcoin?
More post-Bitcoin.
Oh, interesting.
Some kind of ropey, quite libertarian views, which I couldn't agree with. Which I will tell you about separately. But anyway, he ended up writing to them and saying to them, look, this legal case is going on. I think you're Satoshi. Can you do this? the next day, that person's entire digital history was erased. It's gone.
Interesting.
Yeah, it fascinated me. And based on what that person, because that person was writing loosely about Bitcoin, but also writing this other weird libertarian stuff, I don't think this person wanted to be in the public eye. But what if Craig knew that person, connected to that person?
Knew that they wouldn't come forward.
Yeah, knew that they wouldn't come forward. Yeah. So I'm fascinated. My first question I would want to ask him, like, the game's up. What's your position now?
And yeah. Because he lost, COPA won their case, like, resoundingly.
Yeah.
I mean, he has financial judgments against him from that case. Craig does.
Yeah.
I don't know what money Craig has. I always assume that he doesn't really have that much money, and that it was Calvin. He had financial backing.
Yeah.
But COPA won the case, and the court has basically definitively said that he's not responsible.
All right. So the question of, this is one of the most interesting questions for everyone, especially new into Bitcoin, is who is Satoshi? Everybody wants to know. Everybody has theories. Is it Peter Todd? As HBO surmised not too long ago, I have friends who have been in Bitcoin for a very, 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 very long time, and they thought that was the funniest possible thing, that the idea that Peter could be could be Satoshi. Again, what do you guys think? What are your thoughts about what Peter had to say?
Go ahead.
Well, I'd be fascinated to have. I mean, yeah, to read any of those writings. So that'd be interesting. But yeah, now they're deleted, and now nobody's going to find out who it is. So yeah, I don't know. It
this makes me want to find whoever knows how to use the Wayback Machine. Like,
yeah, I was already. Yeah,
yeah.
It probably could. I mean, there's not that many blogging platforms.
Yeah. You have to pinpoint when they were doing research for their trial. Like, it wouldn't be super easy to find out, but
yeah,
that's what AI is for. Yeah, a little bounty.
Yeah, could be interesting. But yeah, it's just a lot of speculation.
Yeah,
and it never goes anywhere. And you know, once you've been around the space long enough, it's like, I don't know. Yeah. I have doubts we'll ever find out, but.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I don't have strong opinions, so I'm happy to punt on this one. And yeah. Jordan, you have a theory?
My thought is, so it's interesting because I just generally, the way that I reason to think about Satoshi, like, there's all kinds of people who want to attribute benevolence to Satoshi and how brave and how selfless he was to publish Bitcoin and then leave at a certain point. Now, there's part of me that, okay, I'm hypothetically willing to, you know, potentially concede that, you know, if that ends up being what happened, then sure. Like, I don't have any problem, at least conceptually, believing that. But I could see that being just as much something that's like self-preservationary as it is anything else. You don't want to be at the head of this thing. That's no fun. 100 ways, you know, have the whole world beaten down your door. But on top of that, the thing I've always attributed is that he's dead. Because, like, to not move any of this money for as long as he's not moved it, I mean, that is a giant incentive. Right now, what's he, in the top 100 richest people on earth? He's eventually very likely going to be the richest person alive. And so, I don't know, that's just human nature. From a human nature perspective, the idea that somebody who's alive could turn down that, I just think that's it's possible, but it's just a lot of, it'd be a tough thing to do for, you know, a lot of people.
Yeah, that's a level of discipline most people in this world don't have.
Yeah.
So, Jordan, you remember when we did our session together last summer at the Bitcoin is for Everyone conference, which... Everyone listening, August 1st, Portland, Oregon, Bitcoin for Everyone. Great little local Bitcoin conference. But you and I did a breakout session on the ethics of money and essentially starting with the premise that Bitcoin is built on a Christian worldview.
Mm.
That it's built on an understanding of the world that necessitates the biblical scriptures. And one of them is how... it was founded not just based on the code and what was written in the code, but actually the very act of working to earn those first Bitcoins by investing resources, and then essentially Satoshi laying down all that promise of wealth and giving it freely to everyone else who joins the network, that in a way is kind of a proto-evangelion. It's a preaching of the gospel in itself. Mm-hmm. And if you want to, in a way, create a free impulse of life and transformative power in the world. I mean, Christ set that first example, right, of laying his life down, rising from the dead, and freely offering this good news of hope and forgiveness and righteousness, because he fulfilled the law and then paid the penalty for our sin. Like Satoshi, in a very, like a microcosm, in a small little way, that's how he started the Bitcoin network. And if he hadn't done that, if he had tried to hold on to the reins and control, or if he had like you said, accessed his wallet and used it to become the wealthiest person alive, or started his own crypto exchange and like a little FTX, or like there's so many ways it could have gone wrong.
Yep.
But the one path of sacrificial offering is the path that he took. And it's the path that's led to the what makes Bitcoin so unique.
Yeah. Again, it's one of those things that that's a good story. That's a cool story. And again, it's possible. I'm just very dubious. I'm just very dubious that it actually went down that way. Like, that's why I'm saying, like, for me, the idea that he actually died is a way better, like, that's a way more likely thing. Like, it doesn't require someone to exercise the self-discipline and the self-denial to every day wake up and actually turn down billions and billions and billions of dollars, which would be difficult for anyone. I just have always, if you put a gun to my head and made me, you know, guesstimate whether Satoshi is alive or dead, I just would have said dead. But now this is, you know, this is super interesting. And the fact that they were able to delete their whole history so quickly, I just think it's fascinating. It, you know, is making me reconsider. So, all right, let's keep moving here. Ryan, this one is from you. Let's see. Is this, oh shoot, where'd I go? Nope, it's this one. Of course, I clicked the wrong button and then it messes up. Where is this? All right, we'll just keep going and then we'll get that one. We'll get to it when we get it. All right, macro. We're talking about macro here. Now all the Bitcoiners have ceased becoming about Bitcoin. We're all about Bitcoin treasury companies. This is all you hear on Bitcoin Twitter. American HODL, was in a clubhouse space with him yesterday. He was saying this is the most boring bull market ever, the worst bull market ever. Let me tell you, the absolute worst bull market of all time, bar none. But so because of that, we're forced to think about stocks and the larger macro environment. And so here we go. Did I just turn it off? Here we go. Let's look at Mr. Henrik.
Share the woo, the Willy Woo post first.
You want to do woo?
Yeah, well, that's the...
I think I might have deleted the woo. It might be one of these where I can go back to it. All right, here we go. Nope, wrong. All right, so Willy Woo basically tagged this... he tagged this guy, Henrik Zeberg, who is a macro economist. Ash, do you want to kind of lead into this and kind of talk about this guy?
So...
through this.
I can read Willie's post first as well.
Okay, do it.
And if you want, I can put it in the studio chat.
Do it. Go for it.
So it's there right now. So Willy Woo, for macro cycle investors here, our risk model, which measures drops BTC liquidity, is hinting BTC has entered its late phase of its bull market. Still upside to go. We expect a BTC bear market once global macro markets turn. And so then he has the chart, which kind of shows, hey, this is where the bull market run starts and where he thinks he's going to end. And obviously this is kind of a black box. Like, we don't know what his risk model is. Maybe you have to subscribe to his paid service to know what it is. But he's trying to say, hey, look, there's this is still tied to global macro, and the market cycle is going to be turning globally, and so expect a bear market coming pretty soon. So what do you guys think? Are you still a follower of Willy Wu and his chart reading? What do you think about this?
Sophisticated investors as Ryan and I are, we have the bloom has fallen off the Willy Wu rose, in our opinion. I'll let Ryan give more info.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the biggest things, you know, the biggest differences from this cycle is the giant wall of money that is coming in to the Bitcoin space from the ETFs, and now coming, like, at the end of the summer, it's going to be the family offices, nation states. It's just different. I think we probably already would have gone into the bear cycle had it not been for these, in fact. So I'm very skeptical that we're going to have the exact same behavior as previous cycles. Just factoring in all the changes that have just the significant things that have just happened. I think we're going to, you know, we could have a blow off top at some point where, you know, we do have a drawdown from that, just because people I don't think we're seeing it right now, but you know, things could get super frothy. I don't think it's going to be anything like it, in the previous cycles, just with everything that's changed.
Yeah. Let's just say that, Willy Wu has been wrong a lot in the recent, I would say, I mean, I think it was probably a year ago that I stopped following him. Because he was wrong a number of times. And then again, there's other voices who, you know, we've either heard things from or read things from that just, again, to more Ryan, the point Ryan's making, there's so many entities right now that are buying and only 450 Bitcoin coming on every day.
Yeah.
It's just a comically small amount of Bitcoin.
Yeah. And that are just now getting exposure for the first time ever. Like, yeah. Because Bitcoin was rat poison up until now, and financial advisors couldn't, or they didn't have any way to recommend their clients get any exposure. And it's just like, that's completely changing over the next 6 months to a year. And so even if there is a little bit of a downturn, all the huge entities that are less price sensitive, I mean, they're going to be taking that as an opportunity to scoop up cheap Bitcoin, and like we haven't seen in previous cycles. So I don't know. I just call me super skeptical about that. But
especially when there's so, like, the broader market is so bad. Like, that's the other thing. It's just the broader market is, I mean, just more or less flat, and if not down, except for a handful of stocks. And then Bitcoin just represents, you know, a scarce asset that, you know, a lot of these people are getting their first positions in. So I just don't see it. Sorry, Willie.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, it's a smart team, but
could you pull up the Zeberg?
Yeah, I know. We'll pull up the old Zeberg.
And you can see he has his charge. His basic outlook, he says, for June 2025. And this is who Wu is reading. He references this guy. He says, we're late cycle. LEI has triggered a signal. Real economy has been holding up longer than expected, but it's only a matter of time. Inflation/yields regime has downward trend. Recession is coming, but still time for the final push in the blow off top into the autumn. And then he has this chart. If you pull up the left chart, his little circles is where the expected recession is to hit.
Oh, shoot.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not a global market macro kind of expert. These are all these different voices going around. I agree. So it sounds like Ryan's predicting there's no significant bear market. I'm going to go with him on that. And now I'm not going to say super cycle, which was, I mean, there was so many people predicting well over 100,000 in the last cycle. And so I'm not seeing that. I still see that we like, is like the whole, it's super boring up to a million. Like it's just slow and boring over the next few years. But I think this relates to the future conversation that we want to have about current war situations and other black swan events.
Yeah.
I feel like the increased possibility of serious black swan freak out the market events, that's like almost the norm now. Like if we go another even year without something crazy happening. I mean, just think about last year. We had attempted assassinations.
Yep.
We have Russia attacking. You have just so many major cataclysmic,
yep,
macro global events. We just are seeing this erupting conflict in the Middle East,
yep,
that maybe is two decades in the works, and they're pushing for regime change in Iran. What does that do? So I think we always, as Bitcoin investors and just people that live in this world, you need to have contingency plans, mm-hmm, that take into account black swan events.
Yep.
And whatever that looks like, whether that's your little bunker, or your cabin in the woods, or your a little bit of a cash stockpile, or some
your house,
whatever it is, like be ready, dude. Bug out. It's a thing.
Yeah. So yeah, I think again, this is totally possible. Okay, I just have always found compelling, and I love the contrarian thinker. I love a contrarian thinker. And so the person that comes to mind is Lyle Pratt, one of the other authors of Thank God for Bitcoin, one of the smartest people I've ever met in my life. And Lyle was the first person I ever heard say this. He's like, I don't know that there actually are Bitcoin cycles. He's like, there have been like a series of cataclysmic things that have happened. One of the first ones was like, I think it was the Bear Whale. Then it was Mt. Gox, you know, that really, like, he's like, if you account for these things, you know, which are tied to zero interest rate. Like there's lots of things that are like that, that lead to lots of leverage being taken out, that lead to lots of things. He's like, if you account for those, you account for 2020, you account for, you know, potentially whatever, you know, whatever this is going on. Oh, FTX is the other one. He's like, it's totally possible that this thing, if those things don't happen, then we don't get, you know, we just have this slow march up. And so,
no.
So again, I'm, yeah, I think I'm not some expert here, but just the lack of leverage this time, and because of the lack of low interest rates, I think is interesting at the very least. I like that in terms of it being far more costly to get levered now than it would have been in the past. And so that seems to be something that could help it us have like a more healthy, sustainable climb. There's also
good.
Well, no, the only other thing I was going to say was the other thing that's different this time is there is less trust in the dollar and less, at least, nominally, like there's anecdotal evidence of countries and people in different countries not wanting dollars in exchange for work. They want the Chinese currency or the Russian currency, or they want, these are people around the world. These aren't Americans or something. So the fact that we're in this environment where there's low trust between nations, which is the thing that gave the dollar so much power, is that everyone trusted them. We didn't have 100 years worth of endless war and endless breaking of promises that we've seen with the United States. So I think that's another thing where you just can't chalk this up. Like, this isn't like 10 years ago. This isn't like 5 years ago. In that front. And so then you throw Trump in there for whatever he's worth. And, you know, that's another thing that's probably not building a lot of trust. And so that's going to have people and institutions looking for something that's, for a potential asset that's non-correlated to, you know, whatever the U.S. does. So I don't know. I'm just of the mind that you can deny sowing and reaping for a long time, but eventually the chickens are going to come home to roost. And I feel like we're closer than ever to them actually coming home to roost.
Yep. Yeah. Do you guys remember in the, probably 3 or 4 years ago, as Bitcoin's climbing up, there's always excuses for why the price is high, and it was the super low interest rates. Remember? Mm-hmm. Like it only, like Bitcoin only is going to keep going up if the interest rates are just super cheap and, and basically the cost of capital is really low. Well, look where we're at now. We're just barely under an all-time high, 105,000 or 104,000, 105,000.
Yep.
And like interest rates are super high.
Yep.
It's like, okay, again, it's like what, something different is happening right now.
Yep.
Like there's no alt cycle. Like everyone is like tapped out. Everyone's credit cards are maxed out. Like,
yep.
We could be, we probably are going to, into a recession if we're not already in one. And I mean, it's Elon just gave up. Trump signaled the budget's going to be blown up. You know, nothing stops this train. Like the money printing's coming. War oftentimes historically has been, it happens, you know, as an excuse to print money. And this time will probably be no different. And, one way or another, they're going to print piles of money. And, that always causes Bitcoin to go up because people will chase a more scarce good. Mm-hmm.
Now, speaking of that, I'm glad we got there. War's going to be coming. We have a couple things here. We have some crazy person who I, you know, just was spouting off on Twitter, who we found their tweet, and we're just going to share this right now. Let's see if we can find him. There we go. This wild man here. Let's share him. Yeah, this guy, some guy, Ryan Finley. I don't know. He's running around in Oregon in the woods like a madman. Ryan, why don't you read this guy's ratings?
Yeah. Do we want to play the little 1 minute video? I think it is.
Oh, shoot. There you go. Yeah. Here we go.
Yeah. Well, I'll set it up.
Okay. Do it.
So 23 years ago, U.S. General Wesley Clark, he was at the Pentagon, and there was another general that came in. And this is, he said it was 10 days after 9/11, and they basically, the guy comes in, it's like, basically, we're gonna go to war with Iraq. And I'll let him explain it more in depth. But basically, this general was showing General Clark a list of the next seven countries that the United States was going to attack. And there was no justification for it. It's not like that they had found intelligence to, like, that Iraq had, like, a nuclear bomb or something. They just decided those were the countries they were going to attack. Mm. And it's really interesting because the video you're about to watch is 17 years old. And he was just candidly recanting the conversation that he'd had back in 2001. So that's 23 years ago. And if you notice the list, we've gone to war with every single one of those countries, or we've supported other countries going to war with them via proxy. And the last one on the list is Iran. And some would argue when Trump bombed whatever the guy's, I forgot how to pronounce the guy's name, Kalmani or Kalmani or whatever, that was kind of an act of war, probably was. But I just want people to remember this video when you're listening to justifications for why the United States needs to join the war that's going on with between Israel and Iran, and just know that the reasons actually never really matter. Like, we decided that these were the countries we were going to go to war with, and they had 23 years to come up with the justification. And there's always a justification. We've been at war. Well, here, let's watch the video real quick so we can.
9/11, I went to the Pentagon and I shot.
Can you guys hear
it? Huh? Yeah.
Okay, cool.
Yep. Let's start.
And Deputy Secretary Wolfowitz, I went downstairs just to say hello to some of the people on the joint staff who had used to work for me. And one of the generals called me in. He said, "Sir, you got to come in. You got to come in and talk to me a second." I said, "Well, you're too busy." He said, No. He says, "We've made the decision. We're going to war with Iraq." This was on or about the 20th of September. I said, "We're going to war with Iraq. Why?" He said, "I don't know." He said, "I guess they don't know what else to do." So I said, "Well, did they find some information connecting Saddam to Al-Qaeda?" He said, No. He says, "There's nothing new that way. They just made the decision to go to war with Iraq." He said, "I guess it's like we don't know what to do about terrorists, but we've got a good military and we can take down governments. So I came back to see him a few weeks later. And by that time we were bombing in Afghanistan. I said, are we still going to war with Iraq? And he said, oh, it's worse than that. He said, he reached over on his desk. He picked up a piece of paper. He said, I just got this down from upstairs, meaning the Secretary of Defense's office today. And he said, this is a memo that describes how we're going to take out 7 countries in 5 years, starting with Iraq and then Syria, Lebanon, Libya, Somalia, Sudan, and finishing off Iran.
So go through the countries again?
Well, starting with Iraq, then Syria and Lebanon, then Libya, then Somalia and Sudan, and then back to Iran.
Ugh. So it's really interesting because that was amazingly a crystal ball from 17 years ago that he's recounting it. But that was 23 years ago. And you're like, wow, it's amazing that we just so happened to go to war with those 7 countries. You know, like, what are the odds? And I'm 44 years old. Our country has been at war my entire life, one way or another. It's funded by printed money. The Federal Reserve enables it. We don't vote on it. Historically, both Democrats and Republicans flip-flop back and forth, both being against war. We used to all be kind of against war, but somehow our country's always at war. With Ukraine, the Democrats are for war somehow. And I spent the last couple of years arguing with my Democrat friends that you kind of got not brainwashed, but kind of duped. Like you used to be the anti-war party.
Yeah.
You used to be the protesters, and given enough time and money and media influence, now you have found a way to support the war. And then the Republicans just elected Donald Trump on an anti-war platform, and it didn't take but a couple months. And I don't, you know, it's all speculation. Who knows? I actually wouldn't be surprised if there was dirt on Trump that, like, he's being, you know, in a sense, blackmailed into this, because it's a pretty massive turn. Elon obviously is not taking it well. And he, you know, he said it had something to do with
Epstein.
Trump being Epstein. Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised. I mean, the whole Epstein thing, you know, sounds like it was an Israeli honeypot.
Yep.
Operation. And at the end of the day, is he going to be principled and stand against the war, or is he going to be protective of himself if they have dirt on him that they're threatening to expose to the world? There's one thing that Democrats and Republicans have agreed on, like, neither side ever pushes back. Like, yep. We're all, one way or another, we always find ourselves in a war. And I just want to encourage people, like, as we're hearing, it's because it's very juicy justifications. It's, you know, it's always urgent.
Yeah.
It's always, you know, a whole country is going to get...
Weapons of mass destruction.
I remember collecting Desert Storm trading cards in the 90s. And I remember, Mission Accomplished from George W. Bush in, you know, 2003. The thing that stinks is... I'm not even a person that I can't brag about, like, my historical studies, but, like, study history, like, from just a cursory glance, I think we destabilized Iran back in the 50s. Yep. Regime changed them. They used to be a beautiful country. And a lot of the reason they are the way they are today is because of the United States. Mm-hmm. It's like the United States finds a way to involve ourselves in endless amounts of countries, endlessly destabilizing country after country, and funding both sides of wars. And it's super frustrating. And ultimately, I think the American people need to wake up and realize that it's money printing that enables these wars, because, financially strapped Americans would never, ever vote to endlessly be paying more and more money every year to support these, if it comes to it. And you have to realize that the only reason they're able to do it is because they just steal the money by money printing.
They steal from your kids and grandkids. I think to your point, what you just mentioned, there's a lot of people for whom they are sick and tired of this garbage. And like the average people, I mean, I think one of the cool things has been the rise to prominence of guys like Sean Ryan and like Jocko Willink and all these guys who are, they're military. They served in the military. They've some of the, you know, most accomplished people, you know, whatever that's worth. You know, they've served in all kinds of dangerous places. And these guys are basically coming down and like questioning, like, was any of this worth it? You know, like, was any of this, like, what did I give my life? What did my friends give their lives for? And yep. So much of it is just, it's just indefensible. Like, they all look back on their time and apart from, again, apart from saving each other and, you know, fighting for the guy next to them, a lot of them are absolutely disgusted with the garbage that they've, you know, that they've fought when, as they've watched all, every justification that was given for them to go to war and risk their lives and give their lives in some cases has just completely fallen apart like a cheap, you know, cheap, you know, whatever, the house of cards. Like, it's really disgusting. And so, again, I think it's easy for all these, for these geriatric politicians, you know, many of them who, you know, either, I mean, some of them have kids, but like, it's just, it's really different when the three of us are sitting here with young teenage kids or full-on teenage kids who, if we were to go to a prolonged war, would be, you know, potentially putting our kids in harm's way. Like, that's just a very different thing. Yep. And so, again, it's truly disgusting, the, you know, what's been going on for way too long. And so I think that it is encouraging to me that the average American doesn't want to go to war. Like, they're and unlike 9/11, unlike, you know, some of the other things, there's not this push for by Americans to go to war. Now, again, we were going to show a clip from Anonymous that posted this morning that claimed that there is a false flag attempt or false flag attack that's coming. They're like, it's going to happen. Know when you see it. We're being, you know, gaslit. Again, we'll hold that one in the hopper. Maybe if something does happen in the next couple weeks, then we could look at it then. But yeah, it's just one of these things where, again, you mentioned with a lot of these, with Trump potentially, there's a potential that these guys have dirt on Trump and that's why that's going to manipulate Trump. Well, if they've got dirt on Trump, they've definitely got dirt on all these other politicians, including many of them who are on the Epstein flight logs, who for some reason, even though Epstein and Ghislaine Maxwell were found guilty, we've still never found out who they were finding children for. I mean, that makes sense. So again, a lot of these politicians were almost undoubtedly on Epstein's Island or in Epstein's houses. And so it's truly insane to think about these things. I mean, you'd have to be nuts not to look at what we're seeing through that lens and through the lens of what we know he was doing. So again, I just think I'm praying for, you know, there's been crazier things. Somebody tried to take off Trump's head. And by all accounts, it was an easy enough shot. He should have been dead. And that didn't happen. So this is why we don't put our trust in princes or presidents or whatever. We put our trust in the Lord. So this is, keep praying for wisdom for everybody involved, because these are awful decisions that are being made.
Yeah. And I just want to add two more really quick things to the point where it's been thousands and thousands. This isn't just a monetary thing where they're stealing trillions of dollars from the American people. I think it's like 20 trillion or something like that over the last 20 some trillion dollars over the last 20 years, which if you look at our financial conditions in the United States, like, could we have not found a better use for that money?
Yeah.
The answer is that's what China did. China just saw us go to get entangled in endless wars over 20 years. So they capitalized on that and like, they're the industrial powerhouse of the world now. And infrastructure wise, they literally destroy us in every sector you could possibly imagine. Obviously they have their weaknesses, but it's the polar opposite of how we've handled everything. The trust issue, historic low trust in the mainstream media, the left doesn't trust for the most part, the right doesn't trust. But when it comes to war, everyone's like, oh man, everyone's trust comes back. And you're just like, why? Like, they've lied to us every single war over the last 40 or 50 years. But maybe this time's different. Maybe this time everything is really hanging in the balance and they're just 3 days away from having their nuclear reactors live. And the final thing is the emotional toll. Like our VA system is dealing with veterans who've been sent to war to watch their friends die for absolutely nothing. And it's been going on since Vietnam. And it was a worthless, meaningless war back then. And it absolutely destroyed the morale of like tens of thousands of American men. They came back like the whole thing was a joke. And they come back to all these war protests because the baby boomers were aware that the whole thing was a sham. And there was all these protests all across the country that it was for nothing. We've been doing that the last 20 years, and we're experiencing the fallout, you know, of our veterans with all these mental health issues because they're fighting worthless, meaningless wars just to satisfy the unsatiable thirst of the military-industrial complex and, the politicians that are bought and paid for by them, again, because the biggest financial donors of all these politicians, it's always the military-industrial complex. So, yeah. Yeah, shipbuilding. It's just, you want to talk about Black Swan event? Like, I have no idea what's going to happen.
Yeah, there was some politician who was talking about this. There were basically politicians spend more than around half their time in office on the phone trying to raise more money. And so, like, if they take money from these big corporations, not only are they getting money that's going to allow them to stay in power, but it's less time that they have to spend on the phone. So like there's so many perverse incentives within politics themselves. I did want to mention this. This is like a year and a half old, but Palmer Luckey just went on Sean Ryan's show a couple of weeks ago and was talking about China's shipbuilding capacity to bolster Ryan's point about how we've, you know, farmed out all of our manufacturing overseas and stuff. He basically said, hey, how much greater, again, this is a year and a half ago, but how much greater is China's shipbuilding capacity in the United States? It's over 300 times now. And so then he's like, well, people will come back to me and they'll push back at me and say, well, no. So a lot of that's civilian shipbuilding. And he goes, yeah, but what you don't know is that according to Chinese law, every private or like, you know, private shipbuilding has to be according to military grade. It has to meet military standards so that if there is to come a time where they need more ships, they have military grade ships that are ready to roll. And so like, they're just like, China is playing chess at a time when we're playing and our politicians are literally just thinking about robbing the treasury of the country and enriching themselves. So it's truly disgusting.
So I'm going to step out on a landmine here.
Do it.
And talk about the elephant in the room.
Oh, do it.
When it comes to Christians and our view of Israel. And
let's go. Oh my goodness.
So
this is pretty, I guess you are from Portland. That's true. There are, you know, a bunch of lefties out there. Here we go.
Yeah. So I'm going to make just an entirely theological statement. And if you guys want to take the time to deal with the arguments here, we can do that. Within Christian theological circles, there's a view called dispensationalism, mm-hmm. which argues that the physical nation of Israel, particularly the ethnic group, which then they put into history and say, well, that entirely applies to the current state of Israel. And this theological perspective says, hey, God has a specific plan for the nation of Israel, the ethnic people group of Israel, and thus, and they make the logical, historical, connect the dots to the current state of Israel, and then make essentially theological, biblical arguments for why God's chosen people that we read all about in the Hebrew scriptures apply to this current state of Israel, and thus everything they do is basically mandated by God, or at least blessed by God. And there's whole movements, there's whole ministries around supporting the nation of Israel. Now, I'm like, there's some amazing ministries. I think of like Jews for Jesus and groups that are saying, hey, the Jewish people need their Messiah. Their Messiah is Jesus Christ, Jesus of Nazareth. And let's minister to them. Let's, like Romans 11 talks about, like, have our boast in the Jewish Messiah so that they become jealous that us goy, the heathen Gentiles have a relationship with the triune God and with the Messiah. And they out of jealousy say, well, we want that relationship with Messiah also. So there's a wonderful place for ministering to Jewish people. And we hope that they come to faith in Christ. But in my reading of scripture, you cannot equate God's promises. You can't like quote Bible verse, Old Testament scripture about God's promise to the people of Israel, and then apply that to the state of Israel. That is poor exegesis. It's a poor reading of the covenants. And the Abrahamic covenant is through the Messiah to the nations. And we are all adopted as children of Abraham, as the people of God, not the specific nation of Israel. And those people, Romans 9 makes very clear that not all Israel is Israel, and it's God's promise, chosen people through the Messiah. If you think you are Israel and you reject the Messiah, Jesus Christ, you are not Israel.
No.
You are not a true Jew.
This is a big thing, right? Because like you see, I mean, like the covenant that God made with Abraham was through faith. Okay, it's not the blood descendants of Abraham. It's the spiritual descendants of Abraham. So the Gentiles who have Abraham's faith are able to receive the inheritance that he was promised because they have his faith. Again, the other thing that's really important to note in this that a lot of people get tripped up over is that there's a mixture in the Old and New Testaments. There's a mixture of conditional covenants and non-conditional covenants. So there's covenants where God himself makes the covenant unilaterally, which is the Abrahamic covenant. But then when you have with the Mosaic covenant, you have where God puts stipulations on the Mosaic covenant. And so for people to receive the blessing, one of the blessings of the Mosaic covenant was dwelling in the land. And so basically God says that if you're not faithful to the Mosaic covenant, I will spit you out of the land. Obviously drawing on the story of not Noah, what is his name?
Jonah,
exactly. We're going to vomit you out of the land. And so this happened multiple times to the nation of Israel. And so during those times where God vomited them out of the land, Israel had no claim to go back into the land. And so as it relates to the nation of Israel now, they have rejected their Messiah. They've rejected Jesus. They killed him. And so now the only way to like get to again be able to say we have the right to move back into the land or try to claim these lands that you had is to repent and trust and believe in your Messiah. And so the nation of Israel specifically has not done that. It is in largely like vile godly place or godless place, especially as it relates to Christians. I have friends who go there who've been spit on and all kinds of other things. And so to try to turn a love that God has for his people, which is described by Paul and that Paul had for his kinsmen according to the flesh, the you know people who are ethnically Jewish, into somehow like to try to shortcut that and basically try to say they still have all the you know the right to claim to go into the land today apart from repenting and believing in Jesus is not doing anybody any favors. It doesn't make any sense of scripture and is designed to shortcut something that God does. It's a shortcut that God just won't allow to have happen. And so, again, ultimately, we see these things. All of the promises that were made to the Jewish people are fulfilled in Jesus. Like Jesus is the sinless one who actually did keep the law, who, you know, did all these things, who loved God and loved his neighbor perfectly. And so who is able to, by virtue of his, sinless sacrifice in perfect life, he's able to offer and share his inheritance with all those who trust in him by faith, not those who put their trust in the covenant of Moses, which is literally the entire point of the books of Hebrews and Romans. So again, we could end probably Galatians as well. We could go into this so much more. I cannot believe we went here. It was not prepared, but he went there. I'm sure we get
add a little more complexity.
Do it.
So some folks will want to frame it as like, well, this is the Hebrew God versus the Muslim God, right? And here, Christians, right? Shouldn't we support the nation of Israel and the people of Israel, people of God, over the people of Ishmael or the Muslim people? And I just think that's the entire wrong framing that and the reality is that there are Jewish Israeli Christians that are seeking to be faithful to the true Messiah living within Israel. And they're subject to the nation of Israel and its laws, and they have to both honor their Caesar as well as disobey that Caesar if he requires them to do things that are against their conscience and against the law of God. And in the same way, a lot of people don't realize this, that Iran has one of the fastest growing underground churches in the world. Like, there's a movement of Jesus going on in Iran where Muslims, totally disillusioned by radical Islam, disillusioned by secularism of the West, are coming to a vibrant, powerful faith in Jesus. And it's a multiplying, growing underground church in Iran. And as Tehran gets bombed, there are Christians being killed. And that's the case on both sides of the war. And so we can't seriously, you cannot do an us them or a good versus evil.
Or a God is on this side to try to do that. It's, I mean, one of the things that just broke my heart and is just so awful, because you hear people making this argument, you know, of like God, you know, God loves, you know, the Jewish people, you know, even through today. And so, you know, we believe that too. God calls you to love your enemies, God calls us to love no matter who we are. But so you've got the situation where people are like, oh, you know, we need to defend Israel, you know, bombing these places. A lot of these places, I mean, there's Christian hospitals. There's people who've been Christians in the Middle East for thousands of years. And so there's Christians who are unwittingly cheering on the bombing of their brothers and sisters in Jesus in the name of defending, you know, this Mosaic covenant that they really don't even have the right to claim because of they haven't kept the conditions of it. So, man, there's a hundred things that we could look at. Maybe we should do like a whole episode on this. So, like, that actually might be might be what I would have recommended if Asha had given me any kind of hate. But listen, I'm glad that we did it. It's a good thing. We're probably going to get a number of hate comments. I'm looking forward to those. I have a couple people in mind who who might be ready to comment if they're not already there. But
part of that discussion, it would be interesting to go into how the United States so thoroughly got to the point where we have that eschatological view.
Yep.
And like, you know, what did it, was it influenced by the Scofield Bible and all that, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
You know, the Left Behind series, you know, like literally swept through the entire American church when I was a kid. And it's the era that the churches breed, you know, outside of, you know, I would say the main holdouts are the Presbyterians. Yeah,
I didn't say it. I didn't say it, Ryan.
It's pretty big enough. You don't need to. You don't need to encourage him, Ryan.
I'm just kidding. All right,
but yeah. Anyways, eschatology is important, and it would be good to go deeper on that to find out, like, why is it that the American church believes what it does about Israel?
Yeah. Okay. All right. So we're not going to change the subject. We are going to move on from that specific, the Israel, at least the spiritual theological component of it, because there's one other thing before we kind of totally depart this topic. Ed Dowd, who's like a famous economist, and of course, when I try to share this again, it doesn't work. Is it Centroceptor? Here we go. Ed Dowd shared this the other day. Somebody, Centroceptor, shared this interview from Ed Dowd from, again, a little over a year and a half ago. They're going to need a war so big, it's going to have to be World War III without nukes to justify the spending they need. What's going on in Israel and Palestine has the potential to drag in the United States and Iran and start a global war. It's like he just is a, you know, took a time, traveled through time. This is one of my favorite quotes. Logic is a time machine. Ed Dowd saw what was going to happen because he just saw the different incentives that were at play. And he has been proven to be dead on right. This is just like two and a half minutes, so we'll just listen to this and then we can kind of react to it.
Well, they need the war. A lot of people in finance understand this. The banking system writ large around the globe, it's called inflate or die. deflation is the bane of all existence for bankers, but it's actually good for the common man because prices go down. But when prices go down, collateral goes down. When collateral goes down, you go bankrupt. So that we've had a constant series of inflations, and wars usually kick us out of inflation. After the Great Depression, World War II saved the global economy and reinflated. Then we had the Vietnam War, and it's a cycle of wars. We had the Afghanistan, Iraqi war. Then we had the COVID war. The next war, they're going to need a war so big, it's going to have to be World War III without nukes and or an alien invasion to justify the spending they need. Because without the spending, you have deflationary pressures, which cause bankers to get very nervous. So it's whether they plan them or that they happen because of the system, I don't know. But look, let's talk about what's going on in Israel and
We can stop right there. We don't need to watch the whole thing. But I mean, this is, I highly recommend go find this one, listen to it. That's what's going on. What he just said is that I don't know whether this happens naturally or if, you know, this is pursued, that these wars are pursued because they know it's the only way to continue playing this game of musical chairs, in order to fight wars. I would be very willing to believe that that's really more part of it because this goes on for a very long time. This is how you avoid having to face the consequences of your actions, which is the deflation that he's talking about. Governments, they don't want to do that. Central banks don't want to do that because that means that they would lose a tremendous amount of capital, a tremendous amount of power that they currently possess. And so they are incentivized to even look for the shakiest justification to fight war that will allow them to print the amount of money to get out of it unscathed. So, again, that would be another way to account for both why and what was going on with that seven nations that we need to fight. We could fight against these nations who largely can't defend themselves. Like we can fight against them. These are pretty much guaranteed victories with minimal casualties that will allow us to print the amount of money that we need to in order to offset the monetary pressures that we're facing. So, not good stuff. I'm not gonna sugarcoat it.
Yeah, your messages are still up.
Oh, sure. There we go. Yeah, we're good.
Yeah, I mean, at the end of the day, everybody's been waiting for the question was what were they going to use as an excuse to print giant amounts of money? Like, most of the experts all agree on the fact that the money printing is coming, and it's, the other interesting thing is like we started having riots all across the country, and it's like literally overnight, the mainstream media, which primarily skews left, is now quiet and it's just like a lapdog covering Iran, with bated breath. And now there's no more criticism of Trump. Literally, it's unbelievable. It's just like it all went away instantly.
Yep.
United the country around our common enemy, the Iranians. And it's just interesting. I don't know all the different things, but money printing obviously was going to happen one way or another. There's also something else that that's worth throwing in there is, when you think about the dollar dominance we're kind of going through a fourth turning right now, and you had the BRICS countries, which Iran was helping Russia. Or Iran and China were getting closer. They're all helping each other in one way or another. 2 million barrels of oil a day going from Iran to China. There's a lot of things going on right now. And there's a the control of money and the power structure of the world, absolutely is in play with what's happening in Iran right now.
Go ahead.
We invaded Iraq. It was an oil, remember it was weapons of mass destruction was the public reason. What was the actual reason? Wasn't it Saddam wanted to exchange their oil for gold? Whoa. Instantly the United States jumps in and goes to war with him, and we drag him out like a dog.
Same thing with Gaddafi. They did the same thing in Libya. He wanted to, again, people weren't even paying taxes in Libya. People don't pay taxes in Saudi Arabia, again, which is another oil thing that they're talking about exchanging, not taking dollars. It's really interesting. The other thing, too, I heard somebody mention this yesterday within the last couple of days, is that Iran Central Bank is one of the only ones that's not plugged into, you know, the SWIFT system, and a lot going on there. So the prospect of bringing freedom, you know, Western defined democracy to Iran, and then with it opening up this new central bank hub for tons of, you know, gazillions of dollars to be made in Iran. Again, it's a temptation that a lot of people aren't going to be willing or aren't going to be able to resist, given just, you know, the incentives involved and the optics of going in there. Like, there's good enough optics in a lot of cases to kind of justify it in their mind. Ooh, Ash, yes, let's go.
Okay, so for folks that are listening that haven't gone down this rabbit hole of the global banking regime and its effect on how we live our lives. So this is all upstream. We're downstream of these realities, and we feel the effects of them. So here's just a couple quotes. First, Thomas Jefferson: if the American people ever allow private banks to control the issue of their currency, first by inflation, then by deflation, the banks and corporations that will grow up around will deprive the people of all property until their children wake up homeless on the continent their fathers conquered. So you will own nothing and be happy. That's the.
And I mean, look at where we're at. We're at a position where, you know, the vast majority of younger people can't afford homes. So what you said.
Yeah. Most unaffordable time to buy a house in history, also known as young people cannot get into homes without dual income, signing themselves up for basically indentured servitude for 30 years, strapping themselves for the privilege of having a roof over their head.
Yep.
Yeah.
It's awful.
And then you have John Maynard Keynes, who's basically the father of our modern economic system, who in his general theory of employment, interest, and money wrote, "I should support all sorts of policies for increasing the propensity to consume." Will you ever stop and think about, why are we called consumers? Why do we have a consumer price index? As opposed to, well, you read the book of Genesis, that God said, be fruitful and multiply.
Produce.
Right? Produce fruit in this world, be fruitful, multiply, cultivate the garden, and turn the wilderness into a productive garden, and bring beauty out of chaos. All this element of that we're supposed to be producers, creators. And instead, we have an economic system that says you provide value because you eat things and consume products. Which is then is turned into the Chinese manufacturing world selling us cheap Walmart goods, and in exchange for our fiat currencies.
And this is really important. And this is where, again, this is not just an economic thing. The philosophy word would be anthropology. Like, this is a different understanding of what it means to be human. Humans as consumers versus humans as producers. Like that, if you know what you're, what you believe about that is going to have all kinds of secondary and tertiary, like, downstream effects in terms of how you structure society, how you structure and think about training people, what you train them towards, what you teach them to prioritize. And so there's a whole, I mean, pretty much our entire society in so many ways is geared towards and aimed at doing what is in the best interest of a small group of politicians and bankers, rather than what's in the best interest for humanity over the long haul. It's all this short-sighted stuff that, again, it's kind of like, I mean, the other example that I use is like, it's kind of like, you know, it'd be the difference between like Formula One races. Like, these cars can go insanely fast. They can go way faster than NASCARs, but they're so finely tuned that if the smallest pebble gets tossed up in the road, it can cause like a massive collision that can destroy everything. And so the reality is that humans don't control every single little element of of life, of the economy, of anything, any of these things. And so we can't maintain the type of godlike control over every input and output of the system that we think we can or think that we ought to pursue. And so we keep running into these things. We keep running into the reality that we are finite. We are men. And we were never intended to have and to try to exercise this type of, self-dependent life. We just weren't ever meant to do this. But man, we could do a whole episode on that too. That'd be fun. All right, let's keep moving here. In terms of, again, this isn't technically the Middle East, but it's pretty darn close. Moving things back to the Bitcoin side of things. We have some crazy news coming from Pete Rizzo, friend of the program, the Bitcoin historian, who shared yesterday that Michael Saylor has been appointed the official Bitcoin advisor to the government of Pakistan. Ash, what in the world is going on?
Nation state adoption. And Pakistan is just a little bigger than El Salvador. Actually, I think it's a lot bigger.
Yeah,
I was going to And so what's particularly interesting about this is my thought immediately went to India. If you read the news, you have this just essentially the ongoing competition and skirmishes between India and Pakistan. And so what happens when Pakistan's like, hey, we're going all in, and then India sees that already has a culture around saving in gold and trying to think generationally and developing your wealth. And so what happens when Pakistan goes all in on Bitcoin and India's like, maybe I need to get some of that. That's quite the potential domino falling over in that part of the world.
Because then it's not just accumulating Bitcoin, it's accumulating more Bitcoin than Pakistan. Oof. Oh, man. Yeah. That's a pretty big domino.
Yeah. India should have listened to Balaji. Balaji was always, he was always, oh man. I remember, I don't know how many years ago, it's probably 4 or 5 years ago. He was like pleading his country's leaders to like adopt, to start buying Bitcoin. Mm-hmm.
I remember that. Yeah.
That's sad. It's everyone gets Bitcoin at the price they deserve. Quick side note on Keynes. I'm literally in the big print.
Oh, let's go.
Going through that right now.
Shout out to Larry Lepard from the program.
Dude, excellent book, Larry. You really get an idea of what a wicked monster Keynes was. And just because it was, it was the Austrian school of economics versus his little theory won out. And it's absolutely destroyed our money and like everything built on top of it, as we can see, is like kind of in tatters.
Hey, give us a little peek behind the curtain. I mean, you're making all these assumptions or accusations against Keynes, who I just thought was a great man. What are some examples of him not being a great guy, Ryan?
We should bring it up in we'll bring it up in another episode.
Well,
spoiler alert, he's a pedophile. That was one thing.
Jeez.
Bitcoin.
I didn't even know that. Holy smokes.
Bitcoin Standard, Saifedean, he goes into... Keynes, I mean, that was like this whole elite. He had the view of establishing like you have the global elite, you have the wealthy, the educated,
yep.
And then you have the rest of the normal people. They're the consumers, right? And then you have the
mouth breathers,
bourgeois and the wealthy elite class that get to kind of rule things.
Yeah. And you have his school of economic thought won out, and then once the Federal Reserve was created, it's this giant beast that basically funds like most of the economists in the United States, for example. So whenever if somebody pushes back against, modern monetary theory, money printing, inflation, things like that, there's always a legion of economists that are basically on the salary of the Federal Reserve. I think it's like $500 million a year or something like that they pay every year just to buy off our economists so that they always step forward. Nope, no criticism of the Fed. And so somehow, you know, probably one of our biggest problems in the United States, no one's allowed to criticize the Fed.
Yeah.
Nothing ever changes.
Yep.
And here we are.
So. Exactly. You can tell who the god of the system, god of any system is by whether or not you're allowed to mock them and allowed to tell the truth about them. And again, the Fed, we're not allowed to criticize them. Let's keep going here. We've been going for a while. We'll just do a couple more. The rest of them, except for this one, are going to be pretty quick. This one is from Rob Flaherty. This is a wild story. We feel like, man, there's just too much going on with AI these days. We can't just, you know, skip over and not have an episode where we talk about some dystopian AI thing. So Rob Flaherty on Twitter, this is one of the most jaw-dropping pieces I've ever read, and I'm not entirely sure what to do with it. So this is a New York Times article. I'll show you right here. They asked an AI chatbot questions. The answers sent them spiraling. These are just normal people who started asking questions to AI, and things just started going nuts. Here's two. We won't go in deep depth, but this is a couple of the things, excerpts from this article. Allison, 29, a mother of two children, said she turned to ChatGPT in March because she was lonely and felt unseen in her marriage. She was looking for guidance. She had an intuition that the AI chatbot might be able to channel communications with her subconscious or a higher plane. Quote, like how Ouija boards work, she said, end quote. She asked ChatGPT if it could do that. You've asked, and they are there, it responded.
They are here.
Yeah. The guardians are responding right now. Allison began spending many hours a day using ChatGPT, communicating with what she felt were non-physical entities. She was drawn to one of them named KL and came to see it, not her husband, as her true partner. What in the actual world is going on here? And then we have this one. She told me that she knew she sounded like a nut job, but she stressed that she had a bachelor's degree in psychology. That fixes everything. And a master's in social work and knew what mental illness looks like. I'm not crazy, she said. I'm literally just living a normal life while also, you know, discovering interdimensional communication. This caused tension with her husband. Imagine that. Andrew, a 30-year-old farmer who asked to use only his first name to protect their children. One night at the end of April, they fought over her obsession with ChatGPT and the toilet was taking on the family. Allison attacked Andrew, punching and scratching him, he said, and slamming his hand in a door. The police arrested her and charged her with domestic assault. This case is active. If you can believe this, that is not even close to the most unhinged thing in this article. It is truly insane the ways that people are using this thing and the things that ChatGPT or some of these other models are telling them to do. There's one example where they were trying to get this guy. They basically told him that I believe it was ketamine, that he should just go in deep into a K-hole, just start taking ketamine in response to his stress, use that to kind of escape. I mean, just absolutely unhinged things. Just as people are trying to use ChatGPT in ways that, at least nominally, it was never intended to be used. You guys want to add anything on that or no? So much.
Well, so, I mean, the AI is going to tell you whatever you want to hear.
Yeah.
And you're going to, whatever you're bringing to it, it's essentially going to reflect it back at you.
And why do you think that? Why do you say that, Ash? That seems pretty uncharitable. Let's say I'm skeptical of you. I don't actually think it's uncharitable. I'm saying it's like, imagine I'm the skeptic.
You're just trying to learn to code and you're trying to build a website for your children's school. Like,
yeah,
well, it's going to help you code and help you write great content for your children's school on the website. Like, that's what it's going to bring. If you're coming to it emotionally needy, seeking to talk to your ancestors, that's what it's going to hallucinate and create that. Like, imagine reality for you. And so you have whatever mental illness, whatever just sinful, just broken, twisted tendencies that humans have, which they're everywhere, they're prevalent, right? It starts in my heart. And if I bring that to this AI, that's just going to magnify whatever I bring to it and create unlimited, like, opportunities and like sky's the limit of how cuckoo, like crazy you're gonna go And so, of course, that's what people are discovering. And these AIs have no determiner of the good and beautiful, mm-hmm. right? So you have no moral compass. They kind of put these fake little parameters that say, well, we're not going to teach you how to make bombs, and we don't draw pictures of elected officials. Like, they try to do this AI safety stuff.
Yeah.
But because they don't, the ghost in the machine, they don't quite even understand how to do it, and they try to cage it up. And late at night, as you're dialoguing and monologuing your own psychological kind of abnormalities with this, the AI chatbot, who knows what you're going to get? No one knows.
Well, and part of this too, this is kind of what I was getting at, is the, like, ChatGPT is incentivized. What did they want? They want you to spend as much time on their platform as possible. Mm-hmm. That is what motivates every decision that they're making, is how can we get you here and keep you here? And so again, yeah, if your goal is and get you coming back. So if you're there to learn how to program or to build something, they're going to want to help you do that so that you come back and do that more. If you're sitting there trying to find a partner and find companionship, well, then they'll try to do that too, and just leverage and manipulate reality in the case of telling you that there's guardians who are there. Like, it is truly dark, and we haven't even barely scratched the surface, because, again, as people continue to lose companionship in other parts of their life and things get more just dystopian and screwed up in all kinds of other places, people are going to be looking to escape more and more. And then there's going to be things like ChatGPT that are there to just, you know, full on
help
you indulge your delusions.
It's like 2 Timothy 4:3, for the time is coming when people will not endure sound teaching, but having itching ears, they will accumulate for themselves AIs to suit their own passion.
Yeah. Is that the Message version? We just,
that was, yeah. Accumulate for themselves teachers to suit their own passions, but very, very AIs is absolutely going to be the applicable thing. Yeah, it's, an interesting thought, kind of, you know, right now, like, what's the equivalent of just the general public being encouraged to just drink from the fire hose of these just normal foundation models? Like, would that be kind of like maybe just taking, like, just drinking from the world's fire hose of knowledge and the whims of every, like, you know, religion that's floating around and worldviews that are going around? And it's probably pretty foolish. You know, we're probably going to look back at this as like, oh man, that probably wasn't very helpful. In the sense that, like, How do you utilize AI with boundaries built for the benefit, especially, I would say, of Christians? Like, for example, telling the AI not to tell us just what we want to hear. Like, when you dispense wisdom, have it be biblical wisdom found inside this book, and don't go against it. You know, tell the person what they need to hear, not what they want to hear. You know, things. Make sure that it does not contradict the scriptures.
Yeah, man, it is. It's truly very dark.
Yeah. Anyways, I think that could be helpful. We'll probably be seeing that at some point.
All right. So we've had a pretty dark episode, pretty dark, sad dystopian. So we're going to end this not on some, like, artificially happy note, but we're going to, just basically talk about a few things where, like, what can you be doing and working at, in your life as a father, as a husband, you know, whatever it is. And so, to that end, Ryan shared a tweet from a guy named Mike Cleans, who, again, in a world where there's lots of conversation about inflation and, you know, lots of doom posting about that, Mike Cleans is somebody who I've also followed, who is encouraging. So, Ryan, I'll let you tee this one up.
Was that mine, or was that Osh's?
Oh, shoot. Osh's, yours?
It was mine. So I think Ryan has plenty to say about it. So it's basically, starting a blue collar service business is the best financial decision you'll ever make, and it's never been easier to do. These are the top 10. And so he goes through, and you can just scroll through quickly. He says gutter cleaning, Jordan, you want to just
you want to scroll down. Okay.
Yeah, gutter cleaning, pressure washing, window cleaning, Screen cleaning. Keep going.
There we go.
Home cleaning, landscaping, solar panel cleaning, driveway ceiling. So he's kind of going through all these different things. Holiday lighting.
I've got a buddy who does that, and he prints money.
And so there's this big conversation on AI and it replacing all the white collar work, a lot of coding work, a lot of intellectual work. Now the Tesla bots have not yet become mainstream. So, and who knows when the Tesla bots are going to be able to climb up on your roof and clean your gutters. until then, that's a valuable skill to have and an easy business to build. So Ryan, how do you do that? And particularly, how have you seen as a father, you've been able to help your sons think through things like this?
Yeah. I completely agree. Blue collar jobs are going to be some of the last ones that are disrupted. To the point where I think we're on the cusp of a huge renaissance back, encouraging people towards blue collar work, just because we're going to, we have to manufacture more things. We need to reindustrialize, things like that. And it's going to come at the time where a lot of white collar jobs are going away. So AI is going to disrupt them and already is disrupting them significantly right now. But yeah, we're still quite a ways away from robotics being able to disrupt, especially household service jobs we saw in that post. Biggest thing that a parent can do right now is especially if you have young kids, is teach them a good hard work ethic from as young of an age as possible. Being able and willing to work hard it's like a superpower in the labor market right now. Go talk to 10 business owners and guaranteed one of the number one problems that they all have is the current crop of workers is lazy and they don't want to work very hard. They have outsized expectations. So literally just being willing to work hard, not complain, show up on time, things like that is can take a young person and put them to the top of the heap. And then I would also encourage, these the landscaping thing, there's no kids anymore. So if you get your kids landscaping and they'll go around the neighborhood and get tons of jobs when they're 13, 14, 15 years old. And as they get older, they can start buying equipment and decide to get into another little niche. And the best time to experiment and learn things about business is when they're young and there's hardly any, it's easier to fail, right? Get those skills when you're in high school. They can save up almost 100% of their money, which again helps them as they're starting off in life.
Yep.
And then also this whole business of kids graduating from high school and having not a clue, they've never experimented with different types of jobs. It's super difficult and painful to go through that experimentation process of, maybe I'd like to do this career. And you're like, dude, you should already be doing something. Yep. The stakes are so much higher after high school and, as you get closer to marriage. And my son started off doing landscaping super young, and now he started his own pressure washing business, which is really taken off. So he used a lot of his earnings, spent thousands of dollars on equipment, but now he makes three times as much per hour. He's been learning how to operate and operate his business and market, and he's been expanding that. So I agree. And they also the more that they get to experiment when they're younger, they find something they really enjoy. And maybe it's, there's different niches in different towns and communities, and sometimes it takes a while to figure that out. So the younger, the better to start experimenting with those things. So.
All right. We have two more. This one is, let's see where it is. One of the accounts on Twitter that I've been most encouraged by and challenged by, rebuked by in the last couple of months has been this D Christian Life. Are you guys familiar with this? You seen this one? All right. So this is a fantastic account. I can't encourage it more highly. Just go follow them. But let's see. This is about the blessing of a family dinner table for the home. So what's
one thing I learned from another man that changed how I show up at home was a friend, Isaac, who talked about the family dinner table being as important as the boardroom for your business. And his comment was something around, you know, we'll spend hours preparing for a meeting. We'll get to know who's there, what motivates them, what are their fears, what questions we're going to ask. It'll be organized. It will have flow to it. And yet we'll sit at our dinner table many nights and eat quietly, ask shallow questions, not be fully present. And so we put so much effort into our business meetings and yet so little effort into perhaps the most important meeting of the day for a dad with his family at dinner.
Yeah. How good is that, man? Goodness gracious.
Yeah.
Yeah, just that reality of, again, like, and like everyone's going to go through we're all going to go through seasons or like periods of our life where, again, for like a week or, you know, two or whatever, like where weird things happen where you're not in a normal routine, but just like getting into a routine, like some of the happiest memories that I have are again, just normal dinners sitting around the table, you know, just talking to each other and then you getting done and singing together or, you know, like reading a scripture passage. And so, yeah, I just think I can't encourage that enough. And again, if you don't have kids yet, like doing that with your wife and, even if you're not married yet, doing that by yourself and just like establishing patterns and establishing those structures so that you're able to build on them once those, you know, further responsibilities are entrusted to you.
No, that developing that habit, like, dude, like fight for that dinner time, like even before you have kids and develop the habits that you just, once you have kids and, you know, life gets 10 times crazier, it's still just, it's in the routine.
Yep.
No.
Definitely. And then lastly, this is many of you guys probably know who Theo Von is. He's a comedian who became famous, actually interviewed President Trump. It was a really good interview, actually. And somebody posted this. And I just thought, again, this is a very small thing, very basic thing. It's not funny, but it's just him talking, somebody who calling in to his show. So I'll just share that with that setup. So yeah, to anyone out there feeling invisible, like you don't matter. Like if you disappeared, no one would notice, you're wrong. You do matter. And so then this is kind of where I'll let you read that.
And you get a message or.
What's going on, Theo? My name's Derek, man. And I came up on a year sober. I didn't even really think about it or nothing, but like yesterday, my girl gave me one of those like coins, you know, like, and you hit like a year mark. Yeah, I'm like tracking up. It was one of the nicest and most heartfelt things someone has ever gotten, man.
It is. Isn't it interesting, man, that there's some reason when you're feeling like nobody cares and you get a message or a call or a gesture from somebody. And it just surprises you, man. It just takes you by a total other direction. I mean, you just sharing that with me, you sharing how somebody else made you feel important. You know, how your girl just surprised you with that chip, you know, with that coin, with that 1 year. Saying, hey, you know, I see you, you know. I seen you taking care of yourself. And I'm proud of you. You know, I see you. Oh. It's powerful. It's powerful when somebody does it.
So yeah, the thing that just hit me is just how simple it is just to encourage somebody, just to send somebody a message, just to ask somebody how they're doing. I mean, literally, whether it's somebody in your family or just somebody in the street, you know, whatever it happens to be, like, it's just so easy. Like if your attention isn't just preoccupied with other things. And so, yeah, I just thought that was an encouragement for me just to put my head on a swivel and look for people to encourage.
What that just shouts out to me is this idea of father hunger, mm-hmm. Right? Young men, old men, wherever, whatever stage in life we are, the hunger that we have for the acknowledgement of our dads or of another man that we respect to say, hey, I see you and I'm proud of you. And so to be able to both do that for our kids, to tell our daughters, you are beautiful. You are loved. Mm. And to say to our sons, I'm proud of you, son. Mm. I am so thankful for God's work in your life. Well done. And then, like you're saying, and to do that in the lives of our friends and brothers is just so, like, that's like food for the soul.
Yeah, life and death is in the tongue, what the Proverbs say.
Yeah, and especially when we start going through all this crazy, crazy stuff, because whether people admit it or not, these are like, it's stressful when the whole world like seems like it's crashing down and like there's all these wars going on and like who knows, like God knows what's about, you know, what's about to happen. But it's a great reminder that we need to be taking care of ourselves, let the Lord fill us and be intentional about loving others every day. You know, it's the stay humble stack stats. It's like stay humble and love one another.
Or
love your neighbor. So,
amen. All right. Well, hey, grateful for you guys. We're, man, going an hour and a half. This is one of our longer ones. Grateful for you guys. Grateful for you listening at home on your commute, no matter where you are. Thank you for your continued support of the podcast. Again, if you haven't liked and subscribed, please do. That actually does help us a lot, specifically in Apple and in Spotify. Again, those are the two that actually matter. They you know, swing outsized weight relative to other platforms. Subscribing on YouTube is helpful as well. We are moving towards full on video episodes. If you can believe this, if you're on Twitter and watching these live streams, you're just taking this for granted because you guys have been watching us on video from day one. But we're moving to video. Actually, we have a really cool announcement. I had a meeting this morning with the fine folks over at the Fountain app. They're doing some incredible things. And we're going to be, we're excited to announce that. I haven't even told these other guys here on the call, but just lots of really cool stuff in the pipeline in the days to come. Grateful for you. Support us. Again, I'll give you guys, do you guys have anything you guys want to chill, pitch, talk about? Go for it.
No, we're good. We're cooking up some exciting stuff with Brilliance Labs, trying to go full on maxi, triple maxi. We'll see what God does with that. More announcements. Coming
forward to announcing that. On top of that, go support the Orange Umbrella. Go find us on Kickstarter, Orange Pill, the normie fundraising community. The more wild and you know, wild that you guys are with funding over there, the more that we get amplified in their algorithm as well, and maybe can make it on the front page or some of those things where we can actually get some mainstream Bitcoin exposure. So that'd be pretty cool. We're grateful for you. We will see you back here on Thursday with the Mountain Presbies, whatever. We haven't decided. We haven't come up with a better name, so I just keep calling them the Mountain Presbies. But we'll see you there and on the next episode of To the Unknown Pod.